1 Corinthians chapter 13, beginning at verse 4, Paul said, "Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil." I want us to study together for a little while tonight about the importance of the very common, ordinary quality of courtesy. And for us to do that in regard to our homes and families. If you remember, way back during the Old Law, we started a series on the family, ingredients of family happiness. And it's been some time since we've tended to that. So we'll do one more tonight on courtesy in the family, and I have no idea when we'll be able to get the eighth one, the last one, but perhaps before the Lord comes back, we'll be able to do that at some point. Courtesy sounds like it's not a very big deal, doesn't it? But it really is. In fact, a lot of the little things in life, particularly in our home life, I think are much bigger in importance than they may seem to be. I'm not so sure, but what a good deal of the strife in some families comes from not paying attention to some very little, seemingly ordinary things. And so this may be one of those that fall into that category. Paul here says that love does not behave itself rudely. If that's true anywhere, it is certainly true in our family relationships. How would you like to live in a family that was characterized by words like these? Discourteous, impolite, ill-mannered, rude, tactless, insulting, surly, crabby, bad-tempered. I read that list one time and a lady came afterward and said, "That's the kind of home I live in." I hope you wouldn't say that. That wouldn't be a fun home to live in at all, would it? But how would you like to live in a home characterized by words like these? Courteous, gracious, polite, mannerly, civil, tactful, gentle, considerate, agreeable, accommodating, obliging, winsome, cordial, congenial, refreshing. Words have the ability to convey an impression, don't they? And two very different family impressions are conveyed by those two different groups of words. I want us tonight, first of all, to think about the need for courtesy in our speech, in our home environments, and then we'll say some things about courtesy in our conduct as well, but we'll say more about the speech aspect of it because I think that's the bigger part of courtesy and kindness, even in life in general. James, of course, warned in his book that it's a bad thing when with the same mouth we praise God and we curse those around us. That would be like a stream giving forth both salt water and fresh water. It ought not to be that way. James 3 and verse 9, he said, "With the mouth, that is with the tongue, we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter at the same time? And can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus no spring can yield both salt water and fresh." In Peter, 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, Peter said, "Likewise you husbands, dwell with them," that is with your wives, "with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered." That passage, Peter is talking to husbands especially, but he says something I think is applicable to every one of us, whomever we may be in our various families, and that is the principle that we can't be on speaking terms with God and not speak as we ought to our family members. Various meetings where I go sometimes, I find myself riding to services with the family that I'm staying with, and then riding back home after services with the family. And it's sometimes amazing how different the talk can be in the car as opposed to the switch that's flipped when we get to the church building and we put on our religious talk. Families can speak so rudely to one another and with such impatience and irritation. How do we think that if we speak and relate that way to one another, supposedly to those who are nearest and dearest to us, and then we're going to get to the meeting house and we're going to say fine, praiseworthy things to God? No, Peter says, your prayers will be hindered by failing to act and particularly to speak to the members of our family in the way that we ought to. And so speech is an important thing, and I think especially in our families. Whether good or bad, our speech, Jesus said, comes from the heart. At the end of the day, how we talk will be an overflow of the kind of people that we are. What's in our hearts will eventually come out. And so there is a sense in which if we habitually find ourselves speaking in ways that we ought not to our loved ones, we're not talking here about applying some communication technique to learn how to speak in a different way. We're talking about character renovation. We're talking about learning to be somebody different so that out of a different kind of a heart, a different kind of talk overflows. It's amazing to me the number of marriage counselors who would say that most of the problems in a marriage are just communication problems. No, they're not. They're character problems. Communication is a function of character. And so the communication techniques are not what they ought to be, then there's a problem there that lies much deeper than just the speech patterns that are involved. And so Jesus said a good tree doesn't bear bad fruit, bad tree doesn't bear good fruit, and so forth. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so that places our family talk in a very serious context, doesn't it? It tells us that if what's going on in that level of our family life is not what it ought to be, then there are probably some deeper issues that relate to our relationship with God that need to be dealt with. I've said before, and I think it's true, that we especially need to be beware of discourteous speech in our families when, as we very often are these days, tired and hurried and grouchy and irritable. A lot of harm happens when we are tired and when we are overburdened with the duties of daily life. One argument for making reasonable effort to get proper rest is because when we live in a perpetually tired mode, one of the bad things that happens there is that we find ourselves getting into the habit of speaking in impatient, irritable kinds of ways. And we are never more vulnerable to what the devil would like to do in our lives than when we are tired and run down, when our resources are depleted and we don't have the resources that normally would help us to discipline our speech. The devil is able to get in there and do all kinds of harm. So I want to suggest that our families need to be characterized by some kinds of speech that the Bible talks about. And these are speech patterns that are important for all Christians in any relationship, but especially so in our families. First of all, just the idea of gracious speech. I don't know what kind of speech that suggests to you, but the Bible speaks in more than one place about gracious speech and uses language to urge us to be that way. Ecclesiastes chapter 10 and verse 12. Well, the word gracious may not be used here, depending on what translation you're using. But in the New King James, it says, the words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool shall swallow him up. Gracious words. You probably would immediately think of the passage in Luke chapter 4, verse 22 in the New Testament, where it said that the people marveled at the gracious words that were falling from the lips of Jesus. You may not have agreed with what Jesus said, but you couldn't have found fault with the graciousness with which he said it. He said not only truth, but he clothed it in words that showed consideration for his hearers. There is a need for most of us to relearn the basic rules of common courtesy in our speech. Even little words like please and thank you can be powerfully good forces in our families. And we can't excuse, if we've gotten in the habit of speaking rudely and ungraciously, we can't excuse that by just saying, well, that's just the way I am. People would just have to accept that because that's just the way I am. Well, if it is the way you am, then maybe you need to start being some different way. You could improve in that regard. So gracious speech. Then what about tactful speech? There's a lot to be said for tact, isn't there? I was looking the other day in Proverbs and came across this one in Proverbs 15, verse 23, which doesn't use the word tact, but that's what it's talking about. Proverbs 15, 23, a man has joy by the answer of his mouth, a word spoken in due season. How good is it? I don't know how you would define tact, but it's sort of the idea of saying the right thing in the right way at the right time. Giving some thought, not just to what needs to be said, but how to say it. As you can see from the word itself, it comes from the same word that the word tactic comes from. And to say it that way makes it sound like a communication specialist is going to come up with the tactical way to say it in exactly the way that's going to get what he wants out of the other person. But tactics has to do with doing something in a way that's conducive to accomplishing the goal, whatever the goal may be. And there's nothing dishonorable about that. And if you think that all that matters in your family is that you say what needs to be said and you say the truth as you see it without any regard to using a tactful, wise way of saying that, then you're probably going to do a lot of damage in your family. A large part of tact is what we would call gentle speech. So I would add that to the list, gentle speech. Paul talks about that in the New Testament when he was encouraging Timothy with regard to how he should go about refuting the error of false teachers. He was talking about dealing with those who perhaps had fallen from the faith, those who needed to be corrected in some kind of a way. And listen to what he says in 2 Timothy 2 and verse 24. A servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition, if God perhaps will grant them repentance, so that they may know the truth and that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. What Paul says there about the way gospel preachers ought to go about dealing with those who need to be corrected says a great deal about the way we need to speak all of the time when there's some disagreement or something needs to be said that would call for perhaps a painful action on the part of the other person. It needs to be done gently. When a doctor has to do something to you that's going to involve pain, you want him to do it as gently as possible. You don't want him to inflict any more pain than is absolutely necessary. And the same is true in our speech. There are times when things will have to be said that are just going to hurt, at least somewhat, but we ought to not want them to hurt any more than necessary. Somebody said the rule in carving holds good as to criticism. Never cut with a knife what you could cut with a spoon. You don't want to use a sharper word than is necessary to accomplish the purpose. And obviously, in the home relationship, there are times when corrective words are going to need to be said. And on those occasions, gentleness is very, very important. Then the Bible talks about peaceful speech. Speech that is conducive to peace rather than the kind of speech that stirs up whatever conflict is there. The Proverbs in the Old Testament, of course, are full of wisdom about the fact that words can either take a problem and make it worse or in some way make the problem better. Proverbs 15:1 says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. I never read that verse, but what in my mind, I don't see that those words written on a 3x5 card and thumbtacked to the wall in front of the microphone where Brother John Humphreys in Louisville, Kentucky used to do his call-in radio program for many years. We take questions from callers on the radio 5 days a week and very often get antagonistic calls. You know, people that would call in just spoiling for a fight. And he had written out this verse, a soft answer turns away wrath. And put that up there where he would see that every time a call came in that would push one of his hot buttons and make him want to lash back. He wanted to be reminded that the wrath of man very rarely accomplishes the righteousness of God. And that a soft answer very often can diffuse an otherwise wrathful situation. We need to avoid quarrelsomeness. In that passage that I just read in 2 Timothy 2, Paul said the servant of the Lord must not be quarrelsome. It doesn't mean that conflict will never need to take place. It certainly will. You see that in the life of Jesus. But the person who enjoys it and wants to stir it up and just gets great delight in antagonizing people is not going to accomplish very much good, certainly in a family relationship. And so we need to be aware that when someone has said or done something antagonistic to us, we have the power, by the way we respond, to either make that better or make it worse. Romans in the New Testament, Romans chapter 14 and verse 19, Paul said, therefore, let us pursue the things which make for peace and the things by which one may edify one another. Several months ago, I had the occasion to meet with some people in another city who were having war. I mean, that's just the only word to describe it. They had just gone to war with one another, and they both knew me and asked if I would meet with them and try to mediate the dispute. And so I met with them, and it was obvious to me when we sat down that nothing was going to be accomplished till we got the fire put out, until we got the situation settled down and some peaceful words could be spoken before anybody emotionally be able to hear what the other person was saying. And so peace is not just something that a wimpy person wants who's not strong enough to engage in conflict. It's the prerequisite for progress to be made in an area where progress needs to be made. You can't do positive good in a conflictual situation. The fire will have to be at least toned down before progress can be made. And my impression is that's very true in family situations where family conflict is going on. And then Paul uses an interesting expression in Ephesians chapter 4 when he talks about edifying speech. When we speak, we ought to want to edify or to build up rather than to tear down. Ephesians 4:29, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. Not a bad test before we speak to always say, is this going to build up or tear down? Is this going to help or hurt? And to govern our speech accordingly. The ancient writer Pindar said, not every truth is the better for showing its face unveiled. That which has not the grace of God is better far left in silence. A lot of people put a great premium on saying exactly what they think. They just take great pride in the fact that everybody knows exactly where I stand. Well, as Pindar said, not every truth is the better for showing its face unveiled in public. There are some things that I may think that just don't need to be publicized. They would not edify. They would hurt the situation rather than help it. And then if you're still in Ephesians, look at chapter 5 and verse 4, where he says, neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather the giving of thanks. Here he's talking about wholesome speech. There are some true aspects of life that just don't need to be talked about very much. Just because something's true doesn't mean that it needs to be verbalized. And Paul here has specific reference to the coarse, vulgar side of life. There are some aspects of life that are true that just the less said about it, the better. I heard a preacher one time say, you know, that every city has a city dump, but you don't take your family there for a picnic. You know, it's there. We need it. We have to think about it once in a while. But that shouldn't be a theme in our conversation. And then finally, and maybe the hardest, is what I would just call controlled speech. Speech where we discipline our words and we force ourselves to say that which ought to be said and to say it in the very best way. If we're not careful, our tongues will get out of control and just speak thoughtlessly and do great damage. So James made a very sobering statement, didn't he, in chapter 1 of James in verse 26, when he said, if any among you thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless or vain. That's a strong statement, isn't it? We pride ourselves on being religious people. We are the Lord's people. Would that everybody took God as seriously as we do, we sometimes think. And then we'll turn right around and speak in an uncontrolled, undisciplined, unbridled fashion to somebody, whether our families or otherwise, and reveal that our religion is useless. It's vain. If what we know about God hasn't taught us to govern our speech, then we haven't learned anything. It's one of the ABCs of the teaching of God. And so, by that definition, probably got a lot of vain religion going on in the lives of people who pride themselves on thinking that they're more religious than their neighbors. Whether our speech is controlled and disciplined or not is one of the first tests that anybody ought to be able to apply to us to see whether our religion is real or not. And I don't know about you, but that makes me really uncomfortable to put it that way. So, gracious speech, tactful speech, gentle speech, peaceful speech, edifying speech, wholesome speech, controlled speech, and we could add some to the list if we had time. Those are suggestions for ways that we can improve in the courtesy of the way we speak to one another in our family relationships. And I wouldn't encourage you to work on all of those at the same time, just pick one or two of those that you think you could make some real progress in and work on that during this next week. But what about courteous conduct? It is a fact that sometimes not just our words, but the way we act can fail in the matter of courtesy and do great harm. It would be helpful, I think, and boy, if I haven't branded myself as being old-fashioned before, I'm going to do it here. It would be helpful in most families, to get back to some good manners. Just plain old mannerliness. Do we even remember a time when people paid any attention to that side of life? Back here in 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 5, Paul says, love does not behave rudely. Now, rudeness is maybe in the eye of the beholder, I don't know what I would consider rude. You might not consider rude, and vice versa. But it's not a totally subjective concept. There's something of substance here, or Paul wouldn't have said anything about it. Basically, the idea of rudeness has to do with acting in a way that is inconsiderate of the needs of the other person. Rude behavior is that which just runs over the other person without any consideration to what their needs might be. On the other hand, courteous, mannerly conduct, always in one way or the other, says, how can I serve you? What are your needs? Let me set aside my wants in the service of your needs. And that goes all the way from speaking in a mannerly way to appearing in a mannerly way before our family and opening doors for other people and that kind of a thing. Mannerliness always puts the needs of the other person in a prominent position. And rude conduct is that which is unbecoming and coarse and inconsiderate. That is, it does not consider the other person. If there's one thing that just pushes my hot button, it's a person who says, I don't care what anybody thinks about what I do. Well, that ought not to be true even for a worldly person, but a Christian will never, never be able to say that they don't care what anybody else says or thinks about them, if for no other reason than that we wear the Lord's name and we carry His reputation with us to a certain extent. We've got to be concerned not to blemish what people think of the Lord if they know we presume to be His people. But how could a right-thinking person ever say, I'm going to do what I think I need to do, and I don't care who thinks what about that? If a person was serious about that, what that means is, I really don't care about anybody but me. I'll do what I want to do, and I don't care what damage it does to anybody else. I'm not concerned about anybody but me, myself, and I. Well, to have anything resembling that attitude would demonstrate that a person hasn't even read the New Testament. How in the world could a person not want to be considerate of the other person if he's read anything about the Lord? Unfortunately, a lot of people engage in rudeness thinking that they're being very strong. And somebody said, rudeness is a weak man's imitation of strength. And I believe that's right. Rude person is not strong in all the true senses of that term. He's simply masking his weakness with a cheap imitation of rudeness. Some of you from Texas, I lived in Texas for 5 years and imbibed the cowboy spirit down there, you know, and I'll tell you, in that culture, a great premium is placed on being a man. I mean, being strong and vigorous and all of those things. Well, that's all well and good. As long as we understand that the true man, the true cowboy, knows how to be mannerly, knows how to be considerate of somebody else. And to think otherwise is not to be dealing with real strength. Rudeness, I repeat, is a weak man's imitation of strength. There are a lot of specific opportunities, I think, for mannerliness and courtesy in the home. Just the plain habits of gentlemanliness and ladylikeness. And I am old-fashioned enough to think that there are such things as gentlemanly conduct and ladylike conduct, and what good those would do in the home. I'll be staying next week with two of my very closest friends down in Georgia, Steve and Debbie Huff. I don't know if any of you know them. Some of you do. I don't know if I've ever known a more romantic couple than Steve and Debbie. And after many years of being married, they are just as romantic and courteous and mannerly to one another. It just will be a refreshment for me to be in their home next week and to see how they relate to one another and now to their grown children. Mannerliness, gentlemanliness, and ladylikeness has done great good in that home, and I think has moved them closer to God. Even ordinary things like grooming and cleanliness and thoughtfulness in appearance. Yes, I know that when we're at home, we ought to be able to relax, and we don't need to dress up when we're at home, but let me tell you, if you think that a certain amount of cleanliness and grooming and thoughtfulness in your appearance, if you don't care anything about that in regard to the members of your family, look at the message that conveys to them. If you'll dress up for your boss, but as soon as you're away from your boss, you're going to be just as much a slob as you can in the presence of your wife, look at the message that conveys to her. That's not just clothing. I was in a home not too long ago where the lady set the table with the finest things I've ever seen on the table. I thought I was at a presidential state dinner. I mean, it was really a beautiful table. But it was obvious that the kids had never seen that table set that way very often. They weren't familiar with what you did with some of the utensils that were around the plate. And I just wanted to say to the lady, I didn't, because it would have been ungracious and it would have been unthankful on my part for the token of courtesy that she was extending to me to set the table in that very fine way. But I just wanted to say, if I'd had an opportunity, why don't you do something like this for your family once in a while? I'm glad that you've honored me, but boy, your family will be honored if you just pull out all the stops and do something really nice for them once in a while. Fact is, we show honor by our manners, don't we? And when we don't show any manners to the people that supposedly mean the most to us, look at what that says. And so let's give some thought to that. Even table manners. I sit at a lot of tables in a lot of different situations, and I'm telling you, I see a lot of things go on at the table. I saw a biscuit thrown across the table not too long ago. And it wasn't in the restaurant, you know, where the waiter throws the biscuit to you when you ask for another one. People can sometimes make too much of that kind of thing, not recommending that we go back to the Victorian era in these matters. But if there was a time and a place when people made too much of these things, we surely have gone to the other extreme and make too little of them. Little things do make a big difference. Even the courtesy that you will show to the other people who have to live in the same domicile with you, the courtesy of picking up after yourself is important. It's just a small thing that says, I'm not just concerned about me, I'm concerned about the other people who have to live under this roof. And this is a together relationship, and I'm going to help and show courtesy to those around me by trying to make their living conditions a little bit better than if I just let myself go to pot. Last week when I was in Roswell with my good friends Ross and Nancy Fink, Ross and I were reminiscing about our first year up on the third floor of B dorm back in the old days at Florida College. And he and I, we lived on the same floor, but we weren't roommates, but we had very similar roommates. Both of us had slobs for roommates. And don't even think that those roommates also had slobs. You know that's not true. But Ross and I had the same experience in that we moved in at the beginning of the year, and for a while, there was just a line drawn down the middle of the room. You know, one side kept very neat, and the other side just like a disaster zone. But Ross really shamed me. I let my roommate's habits corrupt me, and by the end of the year, the entire room looked like a disaster zone. Ross said he decided to start helping his roommate keep house, and he would. When he cleaned up his side of the room, he'd clean up the other side too, and just try to help by being courteous and considerate. And lo and behold, it had a great effect. By the end of that year, their entire room was being kept in a good way. Well, he was more considerate of his roommate than I was. And we got to talking about that, and his wife was sitting there, and we all three just talked about the fact that a lot of the friction that takes place in marriage relationships is due to roommate issues. There's more to being married than being a roommate, but there are a lot of roommate issues that have to be taken care of when two people who've never lived in the same room start living together. And that's very important for roommates to be considerate of one another, isn't it? And that shows up in a lot of different ways. The essence of courtesy, whether it's in speech or in actions, is service to others, isn't it? How can I serve you? Not of what use can you be to me. What Paul say in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4, love is kind. It's kind. Phillips translates that, or paraphrases that this way. Love looks for a way of being constructive. And that's it. Love looks for a way of being constructive. So many of us are guilty of failing to help out, to render service, to do favors. We're only concerned about what the other members of this family are doing for me. And courtesy will improve that environment by shifting the emphasis away from what is this family doing to make my life here pleasant, to what am I doing to show consideration for them. So Roger Babson one time wrote this. I've collected quotations all my life. This was one of the first ones that I ever wrote in my notebook. If things are not going well with you, begin your effort at correcting the situation by carefully examining the service you are rendering, and especially the spirit in which you are rendering it. That's not where most people first look when they're trying to fix a situation, is it? They look at what service is or is not being rendered to them. But he's exactly right. That's the key to making it better, is looking to render great service. Let me conclude with a prayer that I years ago copied down from William Barclay. Listen to this. Oh God, help me today to think of the feelings of others as much as I think of my own. If I know that there are things which annoy the people with whom I live and work, help me not to do them. If I know that there are things which would please them, help me to go out of my way to do them. Help me to think before I speak, so that I may not thoughtlessly or tactlessly hurt or embarrass anyone else. If I have to differ with anyone, help me to do so with courtesy. If I have to argue with anyone, help me to do so without losing my temper. If I have to find fault with anyone, help me to do so with kindness. If anyone has to find fault with me, help me to accept it with a good grace. Help me all through today to treat others as I would wish them to treat me. Well, if we'd live that prayer every day, how much wonderfully better our families would be. So let's work at remembering that love does not behave itself rudely. Well, that leaves us one other lesson in this series, and that will be on the subject of contentment. Well, a lot of families that are suffering strife in these modern days because they have not learned the biblical lesson of contentment. So we'll end the series by talking about that when we have the opportunity to do so. If you're here and we can assist you in obeying the gospel tonight, in any way, if there's some action that you need to take that you've been putting off, but you know that you must deal with this if you're going to be in a right relationship with the Lord, then we sing an invitation song for the purpose of providing you an opportunity. And we hope that you won't let the opportunity get away from you. Just don't know whether you'll even get home tonight if you don't take advantage of this opportunity to do what you know is right. We can help you. Won't you come while we stand and sing?